Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell, and today I'm here with co-host Russ Chianelli. And we're going to be talking to yet another Nobel laureate. His name is Frank Wilczek. He's the Herman Feshbach Professor of Physics at Massachusetts Institute of Technology. And we're going to have a lot of fun learning about strong forces, and we're going to learn about symmetry. So first of all, Frank, welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And before we get into what's the strong force and, you know, all this business about symmetry and shape and et cetera, how did you become a scientist? What were those formative years? Was it when you were 6 and 7, 16, 17? Or how did it work?
16 or 17 months, I remember my very earliest memories are sitting in our kitchen and taking apart and putting together many, many times a coffee percolator that we had, seven or eight pieces, and just realizing suddenly that, you know, I was a separate being and that there was a world out there and that I could manipulate it and control it. So from a very early age, I was interested in big numbers. I saved up to buy a telescope when I was in kindergarten, and I was always very interested in manipulating numbers and doing experiments with changing money back and forth, and also doing magic tricks. So I was born to do this kind of work, I think. So I wanted to do something mathematical, but I didn't know what, and considered several different possibilities, maybe trying to figure out how minds work, computer science and neurobiology. I also was very interested in philosophy in the form of mathematical logic. But at the time I had to make my mind up, really, which way to jump. I was a graduate student in math because I didn't wanted to keep my options open, but I didn't really want to do pure math. Anyway, I was at Princeton, and very exciting things were happening. It was clear in physics at that time, and it would use the kind of mathematics I really liked about symmetry and analysis, and so I jumped in that direction, and I've never looked back.
Well, let's just go back to those early years when you were putting together the coffee percolator. Were you an experimentalist also in the sense that you try to make coffee after you put it back together, and
no,
you did it the wrong way several times?
No, I was a theorist even
back. Oh, okay.
My father was a radio and television repairman kind of technician, and we had all that electronic stuff. He was also, you know, a collector. We had lots of pioneering radios and one-inch televisions in our house, and that was very impressive. You know, lots of vacuum tubes, and I played with that.
So let me ask you a question. When you were a kid there, when did you look up at the stars and realize that, hey, these things are far away and maybe it's an infinite space, and how did that affect you?
Well, I can't remember a moment when I didn't think that, but I just realized I was very small, that the universe was very big, and also that it had a lot of interesting objects. I wanted to learn about all the different planets, their sizes, and what the gravity would, I imagined myself being on different planets, and what their gravity would be like. When I was
trying to walk on Jupiter or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. When I was in my pubescent years, 7, 8, and 9 was the time of the height of the space race and the Cold War. So this stuff was very much in the air, the power of exploring space and the importance of space. So it wasn't hard to relate to that.
And expand your imagination, that's for certain. Let's go then. You're in graduate school. We've understood that you were going to do what you were going to do right from the beginning. And then you had this problem. Can you remember when you first went in to see and talk with your supervising professor, and you might tell us who that is, how did he approach the subject of a good puzzle for you to solve?
Well, my thesis advisor was David Gross, who I met through a course he was teaching on quantum field theory. That's what and I proposed several different things to, and we briefly investigated different things that didn't work, but then he was very interested in the question of whether one could find a consistent realization of quantum mechanics and relativity, that would have forces that got weaker instead of stronger at short distances. This was a puzzle that, because some experiments seem to indicate that one wanted that kind of behavior in the strong force. And the mathematical tools for investigating that question were just being developed. So it was hard to investigate, yet sort of within sight. And so I was very interested in investigating that to see if this was a consistent possibility for the weak interactions, where there were, already was a theory, and the kind of theory that the weak interactions, it turned out that the kind of theory that was used for the weak interactions, so-called gauge theories.
This was at Princeton?
This was at Princeton. Gives just the kind of behavior that was needed for the strong interaction.
Before we get into the detail, the nitty-gritty, so to speak, I think for our audience, a few definitions, simple definitions in as laid terms as you can make it. Strong forces, weak forces.
Yes.
How do people relate to those in the way that you understand them and how you can translate that to the non-physicist?
Well, there are four basic forces of nature. There's gravity and electromagnetism, which have been known for a long time and had beautiful theories for quite a while. Gravity had first Newton's theory, which was the, you know, sort of the high point of the scientific revolution, and then later Einstein's general relativity. Electromagnetism has Maxwell's equations, which give a marvelous, very productive description of electricity and magnetism. But then in the first part of the 20th century, as people started to explore interiors of atoms, as experiments began to probe those, and people learned that there were tiny atomic nuclei in the core of atoms surrounded by electrons, they realized that that one couldn't describe the dynamics of atoms using just electrical and gravitational forces. New forces were needed, particularly to hold atomic nuclei together, because atomic nuclei have a tremendous concentration of positive charge. Like charge repels, so they should just blow up electromagnetically. And the masses are so small that gravity isn't important. So you needed some new kind of force. And, well, one of the, maybe the top question on the agenda of theoretical physics starting in the 1930s, once quantum mechanics was in place, was, what are these forces? Can we find equations that we're ready to put on the same level as Einstein's general relativity or Maxwell's equations to describe these new forces? And, well, it was a long struggle to find the adequate concepts and have the right experimental information to do justice to those questions. That's what happened. We found that there are two forces needed, a strong force basically to hold the nuclei together. So that's the strongest force in nature. We learned that the protons and neutrons that make nuclei are in turn made out of quarks and gluons, simpler particles. And so the strong force is really the theory of the forces between quarks and gluons. And the weak force has to do with various radioactive decays. It's more complicated. And let's not talk about that.
Okay, really good.
But it's another necessary and important force.
Okay.
Well, I always got in trouble talking about the quantum entanglement.
Well, quantum mechanics is vital to understanding what's going on inside atoms. So quantum mechanics is lurking in the background of this. Everything we calculate is entangled. So entanglement...
That is such a truism.
Entanglement has become interesting in modern investigations because it's a way of seeing simple quantum mechanical effects in their purest form. And now with people having very good control of single atoms or single particles, we can start to explore kind of quantum mechanics in its pristine, simplest embodiments. But when we deal with the strong force and atomic nuclei and sort of quantum mechanics as it occurs in the natural world, it's much more complicated, and that means we have not less entanglement, but much more. So to practicing atomic or nuclear physicists, entanglement is hardly a new story. It's what we've been dealing with all along.
Let's go back to that when you were the graduate student, when you were doing this high-powered math and trying to untangle these features, and then when you began to see that at the end of your studies or your end of your investigation, a solution, how excited did you get? Was it just, oh, I'm just doing what I know I can do and it will come out? Or was there much more of a blood rush and say, my God, I think we may have something?
Or maybe this is not right.
it was a process. Well, there were two aspects to this. First of all, there was getting the crucial calculation done. And that, since it was a difficult calculation, it wasn't even clear what the rules were at that time. It was breaking new ground and sort of daring. It was a daring calculation that we sort of made up. I sort of made up the rules of how you do it as I went along. So it wasn't fully controlled, but since I wanted to have many, many checks, I did calculated the key phenomena in many different ways to make sure that the different ways, although I didn't have confidence in any one of them, that they all worked, that they all at least gave the same answer. So that was exciting in a way to get it all to agree and come out right. It was also frustrating. You know, I filled a large notebook with dense calculations to get it right after a lot of debugging. So it was a great moment to get to finally have it all consistent and working, and to get the answer kind of that was the most interesting. We found that these kinds of theories, these so-called non-abelian gauge theories, very special theories, had behavior different from all other theories that has been investigated up to that time.
And when you got sort of convergence, when all these things were from different angles coming to the same, did you go out and have a drink, or did you just sort of sit down and think, now how do I write this up for a big paper?
I had a nice long sleep, I think. In those days, I used to regularly put in 20-hour days of calculation and collapse on weekends, or collapse when I felt that I could when something was finished. So I don't remember exactly what I did. And as I say, it was a process.
Right.
I'm not sure there was a moment when I suddenly realized it worked, because
One thing that comes to my mind is, as you did this and what's changed now, you know, we teach all the students how to use computers and simulate and all that. Can you talk a little bit about how the electronics affected your ability to do this? Were you doing this by hand first, and then all of a sudden you used a...
It was almost entirely done by hand. With follow-up work, though, I started using a PDP-10, the famous experimentalist, in fact, Nobel Prize-winning experimentalist Val Fitch had this, at the time, top-of-the-line computer that he used in his experimental work, but at night it was unused. So he let me use it. And to give you an idea, the output was on...
cards or tape,
toilet,
yeah.
It would have looked like toilet paper.
Yep.
On a roll that came out. It was a big step up over punch cards, but still. Anyway, so we did... When it came to relating the theory to experiment and doing detailed calculations of what to expect in experiments, I started using computers, and to do more elaborate follow-up work, I did use computers. But the first wave of work, since it was so exploratory, since really I didn't have a firm grasp of everything I was doing, I couldn't really tell what computer what to do. I was figuring it out on the fly. And so that was almost all by hand.
You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm here with co-host Russ Chianelli today, and we're talking to Frank Wilczek, who's a professor of physics at Massachusetts Institute of Technology and a Nobel laureate from the year 2004. We're talking about strong forces and really hard work that takes to 20-hour sessions every day. That's a lot of work. We'll be back in one moment. Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Russ Chianelli, and Frank Wilczek, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, Professor of Physics, and Nobel Laureate 2004.
It occurs to me, let me just, if I may.
Yes.
It occurs to me that was phase one, I said. You asked me about the sort of history of realization of what this was about. And so doing the calculation to get a result, that was phase one. The next phase was really nerve-wracking, which was, first of all, putting it out there and seeing if any colleagues would poke holes in it, And then even more nerve-wracking, I was pretty confident about that, but even more nerve-wracking was experiments, whether the experiments would agree with this theory. I remember vividly telling David Gross, who was my collaborator and advisor on this, that if this were correct, we would probably get a Nobel Prize for it. But he didn't think so, but I did. And but it was a big if. The experiments were very far from clear or decisive. And really, although there were encouraging signs within a couple of years, it was not till almost 20 years later that the situation was really, really clear, and the people in Stockholm began to began to take it seriously, I guess.
Well, let's actually follow that up a little bit. So you're a theoretician, right? We learned that from your coffee percolator days. So who are the people that you were collaborating with or guiding to set up the experiments? And what were those experiments? Oh. Where were they done?
Okay, so the experiments that first suggested that the force would get weak between quarks and, well, that there were quarks, were done before our work, primarily at the Stanford Linear Accelerator in Stanford, and that was recognized by a Nobel Prize for Jerome Friedman, Kendall, and Taylor, I think in 1999, something like that, maybe 1995. Anyway, so that work was in the background and kind of inspired our work. But modern high-energy physics is a huge international enterprise with big experiments that have a lot of inertia. It wasn't, actually, I didn't myself hire postdocs or direct experiments or anything like that. It was much more indirect. We put out predictions and hoped that they would inspire some of these big experimental collaborations to analyze their data and check whether these predictions, in fact, describe the world.
Have you ever been out there to the Linear Accelerator? I have a long history working with...
Oh, sure. Yeah. Well, I shouldn't say, oh, sure. Yes, I did. I've been to most of these accelerators kind of as a tourist.
What my question really is, and I went through all that, and we were going to build some of these high-energy things that allowed us to do these experiments, and it kind of broke down in the United States. Well, we were going to do one here in Texas, and they were digging tunnels, and then CERN came along, and I always was disappointed that we didn't build better ones here.
There was a kind of fiasco in support of fundamental research on high-energy physics in the United States when there was a great project called the SSC, the
yep.
Superconducting Supercollider, that was not only planned, but it was sited, and the tunnel was underway at near Waxahachie, Texas.
Yep.
And then it was just canceled.
Yep.
It's not clear to me even to this day exactly why, and it was a great pity because it set back the field by 10 or 15 years, and later the LHC, the CERN laboratory, has had the glory of discovering the Higgs particle and really cementing our understanding of fundamental forces and may well take the next step in discovering supersymmetry or what the dark matter is, many opportunities
yep.
that we could have had. We had it in
yeah, our- I know. That's a good question.
That brings up an interesting point because you say, well, it put back high-energy physics, you know, a decade
yeah.
or 14 years, I think you quoted. But in a sense, that's nothing. All right. I mean, I remember interviews with Rutherford when he did his famous experiment. And somebody asked him, you know, well, aren't you so proud of this experiment? He said, if I hadn't done it and published it now, somebody else would have done it 6 months later. All right. I mean, it does put in perspective this concept of discovery. And so.
Yes, I mean, that's true, but. How should I say? I don't think one should think too much about that because it's true. Somebody, you know, many people might have made the discovery, but in fact, someone in particular did, and Rutherford deserves all the glory he got for doing that. And you know, it's like voting. No one person's vote matters, but if everybody has that attitude.
Well, one final thing before we move on to this lovely book, A Beautiful Question. You mentioned when you were doing your work that you understood at the time, you know, it was very daring. Do you begin to see the way that science is funded around the world, that daring is one of the least clear aspects of what people are doing? I mean, daring just doesn't seem to get through to the people who have to fund this.
Yeah, I'm quite concerned, actually, about the short-termism of a lot of science funding these days, where grants are for short periods of time, they're frequently reviewed, and have to have kind of a clear program of what they're going to deliver after 3 years.
Or exactly.
After 3 years. I think that's very stultifying and sort of almost at war with the mission of what truly basic research should be. I mean, research that's going to lead to useful products, or, you know, that has a clear direction of using existing concepts to get to a well-defined goal. That's the kind of thing that industry can support and does support, and the kind of research that's more visionary, that in the past has led to things like Maxwell's equations and the discovery of quantum mechanics, and so it was curiosity-driven. They could not have given a programmatic description saying, okay, in 5 years I'm going to understand the theory of the electric and magnetic forces, or in 10 years I'm going to understand how atoms work. It needs some level of security for young people at the beginning of their careers, that they can take on challenges that it's not clear what the end of it is.
Before we leave that, I mean, are you in a position, being a Nobel laureate, and there are a lot of people who follow exactly the logic you just went through, that do you have frequent meetings? Are you on advisory boards to NSF, NIH, DOD, et cetera, which would allow this to become more of a discussion point? Because I don't see it happening at the moment.
No, I try to avoid myself being on advisory boards, because I have dabbled in it, and I found it very frustrating. So I haven't taken that on. I do give advice when asked, but I don't seek out positions.
So you don't write editorials.
Okay, now we're going to talk about your book, A Beautiful Question, which is something that I think is one of the best accomplishments. You know, you won the prize, and all of a sudden you began to think about, what does this all mean? And it's something that's always kept me up at night, too, when I was very young. And there you go back to Pythagoras. But you talk about how these people thought about it and how they created in their minds numbers. Could you talk a little bit about that? Beautiful question.
Well, I should hasten to add that this is an act of imagination, imaginative reconstruction, especially in the case of Pythagoras, who's kind of a figure of legend. I don't know that I'm not at all certain. In fact, I'd be very surprised if the thought processes I ascribed to Pythagoras were actually
questions.
But it goes to his school and the influence of the Pythagorean legend. So it's really the Pythagoreans, and similarly for Plato, it's not only Plato but Platonism. The history of ideas is I found absolutely fascinating when I dug into it, and the ideas of those people in particular that up at the base of the world were beautiful concepts of symmetry and of number and of musical harmony.
Yeah, the music was something that really struck me about the strings, him figuring out one is twice as long, so you have an octave.
Yes.
And then he figured out the numbers for the thirds and fifths. If you're a musician, it's amazing that this beauty is there. And then you write about how the ear responds to this.
Yeah, well, this is the great discovery of Pythagoras that, in modern terms, corresponds to the fact that the tones that sound harmonious to us are ones whose frequencies are in ratios of small whole numbers. This is, like, to me, was the first great discovery in science, certainly outside of a discovery of astronomical regularities. But to this day, it's really not understood why it's true. And I found that quite fascinating and very relevant, of course, to the question of beauty in the world. This is one aspect of beauty that goes very deep and had made a huge impression on Pythagoras, obviously, and everyone ever since talked about music of the spheres and sense of harmony. And I thought very hard about it. I've thought about it for years, actually. And I think I have a pretty good idea about why it happens, which is that if you have those kinds of tones that are related in these simple mathematical ways, it means that the vibration patterns that arrive in our ears are predictable. From part of it, you can predict what happens later successfully, because it's very repetitive if the chords have notes that are related in frequency, simply. Whereas if they're slightly off, like if you play a C and a C sharp together, then it repeats for a while, so it looks like it's making sense, but then it's wrong. So I believe that what makes it beautiful to us is the fact that we can predict its behavior successfully. If you think about the kind of thing that evolution would like to encourage, it likes to encourage us to do things that help us survive, and in particular to prove to get along in the world. And if we make successful predictions, that's something that helps us get along in the world, something we get rewarded for, and I think therefore something we find beautiful.
And I can predict that we've come to the end of the program, Frank.
Oh.
So let me just one quick question. Do you play a musical instrument?
Yes, I play several, actually, but I grew up on the accordion. I played the piano. In an intermediate stage, I played drums also.
All right. Frank Wilczek, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, Nobel Laureate 2004. Thank you so much for being here on Science Studio. It's been fascinating.
We could have talked a lot longer, but I hope.
Oh, well, we might call back. I've got to read your book. The book is a beautiful question, and it looks magnificent, but I haven't opened it yet. So,
thanks to Norma Martinez, our producer, who is a musician.
We'll be back next week with another Science Studio, so stay tuned. Bye-bye.